Chapter 2. 3 years. Conrad's voice. A miracle. Reverend Jacobs got fired because of the sermon he gave from his pulpit on November 21st, 1965. That was easy to look up on the internet because I had a landmark to go by. It was the Sunday before Thanksgiving. He was gone from our lives a week later, and he went alone. Patsy and Morris, dubbed Tagalong Maury by the kids in MYF, were already gone by then. So was the Plymouth Belvedere with a push-button drive. My memory of the 3 years between the day when I first saw Peaceable Lake and the day of the terrible sermon are surprisingly clear. Although before beginning this account, I would have told you I remembered little. After all, I would have said, how many of us remember the years between 6 and 9 in any detail? But writing is a wonderful and terrible thing. It opens deep wells of memory that were previously capped. I feel I could push aside the account I set out to write and instead fill a book, and not a small one, about those years and that world, which is so different from the one I live in now. I remember my mother, standing at the ironing board in her slip, impossibly beautiful in the morning sunshine. I remember my saggy-seated bathing suit, an unattractive Loudon green, and swimming in Harry's pond with my brothers. We used to tell each other the slimy bottom was cow shit, but it was just mud, probably just mud. I remember drowsy afternoons in the one-room West Harlow school, sitting on winter coats and spelling corner and trying to get poor, stupid Dickie Osgood to get giraffe right. I even remember him saying, Why should I have to spell one when I'll never see one? I remember the webwork of dirt roads that crisscrossed our town, and playing marbles in the schoolyard during frigid April recesses, and the sound the wind made in the pines as I lay in my bed, prayers said, and waiting for sleep. I remember my father coming out of the garage with a wrench in his hand, and his Morton fuel oil cap pulled low on his forehead, blood oozing through the grease on his knuckles. I remember watching Ken McKenzie introducing Popeye cartoons on the Mighty 90 show, and how I was forced to give up the TV on the afternoons when Claire and her friends arrived, because they wanted to watch American Bandstand and see what the girls were wearing. I remember sunsets as red as the blood on my father's knuckles, and how that makes me shiver now. I remember a thousand other things, mostly good ones, but I didn't sit down at my computer to put on rose-colored glasses and wax nostalgic. Selective memory is one of the chief sins of the old, and I don't have time for it. They were not all good things. We lived in the country, and back then, country life was hard. I suppose it still is. My friend Al Knowles got his left hand caught in his father's potato grater and lost 3 fingers before Mr. Knowles could get the bulky, dangerous thing turned off. I was there that day, and I remember how the belts turned red. I remember how Al screamed. My father, along with Terry, his faithful if clueless acolyte, got the road rocket running. God, what a gorgeous, blasting clatter it made when he revved the engine and turned it over to Dwayne Robichaux, newly painted and with the number 19 emblazoned on its side, to race at the speedway in Castle Rock. And the first lap of the first heat, the idiot rolled it and totaled it. Dwayne walked away without a scratch. "Accelerator pedal must have stuck," he said, grinning his foolish grin. Only he said, "Ass-celerator," and my father said the only ass was the one behind the wheel. That will teach you to ever trust anything valuable to a Robichaux, my mother said. And my father stuffed his hands so deep into his pockets that the top of his underwear showed, perhaps to ensure they would not escape and go someplace they weren't supposed to. Lenny McIntosh, the postman's son, lost an eye when he bent down to see why the cherry bomb he'd put in an empty pineapple tin didn't go off. My brother Conrad lost his voice. So, no, they weren't all good things. On the first Sunday that Reverend Jacobs took the pulpit, There were more people present than had been there in all the years fat, white-haired, good-natured Mr. Latour had kept the church open, preaching his well-meant but obscure sermons and reliably welling up at the eyes on Mother's Day, which he called Mother's Sunday. These details came courtesy of my own mother, years later. I barely remembered Mr. Latour at all. Instead of 20 congregants, there were easily four times that number. And I remember how their voices soared during the doxology. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, ye creatures, here below. It gave me goosebumps. Mrs. Jacobs was no slouch on the pedal organ either, and her blonde hair, held back with a plain black ribbon, glowed many colors in the light falling through our only stained glass window. Walking home from church en famille, our good Sunday shoes kicking up little puffs of dust, I found myself just behind my parents, so heard Mom expressing her approval, also her relief. I thought, him being so young and all, we'd get a lecture on civil rights or banning the draft or something like that, she said. Instead, we got a very nice Bible-based lesson. I think people will come back, don't you? For a while, my father said. She said, oh, the big oil baron, the big cynic, and punched his arm playfully. As it turned out, they were both sort of right. Attendance at our church never slumped back to Mr. Latour levels, which meant as few as a dozen in winter, huddled together for warmth in the drafty, wood-stove-heated church. But it dropped slowly to 60, then 50, and finally to 40 or so, where it hovered like the barometer on a changeable summer day. No one ascribed the attrition to Mr. Jacobs' preaching, which was always clear, pleasant, and Bible-based, never anything troubling about A-bombs or freedom marches. Folks just kind of drifted away. God isn't as important to people now, my mother said one day after a particularly disappointing turnout. A day will come when they'll be sorry for that. During those 3 years, our Methodist Youth Fellowship also underwent a modest renaissance. In the Latour era, there were rarely more than a dozen of us on Thursday nights, and four were named Morton: Claire, Andy, Con, and Terry. In the Latour era, I was considered too young to attend, and for this, Andy sometimes used to give me head noogies and call me a lucky duck. When I asked Terry once what it was like back then, he gave a bored shrug. We sang songs and did Bible drills and promised we'd never drink intoxicating liquor or smoke cigarettes. Then he told us to love our mothers, and the Catholics are going to hell because they worship idols, and Jewish people love money. He also said to imagine Jesus is listening if any of our friends tell dirty jokes. Under the new regime, however, attendance swelled to 36 kids between 6 and 17, which necessitated buying more folding chairs for the church basement. It wasn't Reverend Jacob's mechanical Jesus toddling across Peaceable Lake. The thrill of that wore off rapidly, even for me. I doubt if the pictures of the Holy Land he put up on the walls had much to do with it either. A lot of it was his youth and enthusiasm. There were games and activities as well as sermons, because, as he pointed out regularly, most of Jesus' preaching happened outside, and that meant there was more to Christianity than church. The Bible drills remained, but we did them while playing musical chairs, and quite often someone fell on the floor while searching for Deuteronomy 14, verse 9, or Timothy 2, 12. It was pretty comical. Then there was the ball diamond, which Con and Andy helped him create out back. On some Thursdays, the boys played baseball, and the girls cheered us on. On alternate Thursdays, it was the girls playing softball, and the boys, hoping some of the girls would forget it was their turn and come in skirts, cheering them on. Reverend Jacob's interest in electricity often played a part in his Thursday night youth talks. I remember one afternoon when he called our house and asked Andy to wear a sweater on Thursday night. When we were all assembled, he called my brother to the front of the room and said he wanted to demonstrate the burden of sin. Although I'm sure you're not much of a sinner, Andrew, he added. My brother smiled nervously and said nothing. This isn't to frighten you kids, he said. There are ministers who believe in that kind of thing, but I'm not one of them. It's just so you'll know. This, I've learned, is the kind of thing people say just before they try to scare the living crap out of you. He blew up a number of balloons and told us to imagine that each one weighed 20 pounds. He held the first up and said, "This one is telling lies." He rubbed it briskly on his shirt a few times and then held it against Andy's sweater, where it stuck as if it were glued there. "This one is theft." He stuck another balloon to Andy's sweater. "Here's anger." I can't remember for sure, but I think it likely he stuck 7 balloons in all to Andy's homemade reindeer sweater, one for each of the deadly sins. "That adds up to over 100 pounds of sin," he said. "A lot to carry. But who takes away the sins of the world?" "Jesus," we dutifully chorused. "Right. When you ask him for forgiveness, here's what happens." He produced a pin and popped the balloons, one after another, including one that drifted free and needed to be stuck back on. I think we all felt the balloon-popping part of the lesson was quite a bit more exciting than the sanctified static electricity part. His most impressive demonstration of electricity in action involved one of his own inventions, which he called Jacob's Ladder. It was a metal box, about the size of the footlocker my toy army lived in. 2 wires that looked like TV rabbit ears jutted up from it. When he plugged it in, this invention ran on wall current rather than batteries, and flipped the switch on the side, long sparks, almost too bright to look at, climbed the wires. At the top, they peaked and disappeared. When he sprinkled some powder above this device, the climbing sparks turned different colors. It made the girls ooh with delight. This also had some sort of religious point, at least in the mind of Charles Jacobs it did, but I'll be damned if I remember what it was. Something about the divine trinity, maybe. Once the Jacobs ladder wasn't right there in front of us, the colored sparks rising and the current fizzing like an angry tomcat, such exotic ideas had a tendency to fade away like a transient fever. Yet I remember one of his mini lectures very clearly. He was sitting on a chair that was turned around so he could face us over the back. His wife sat on the piano bench behind him, hands folded demurely in her lap, head slightly bowed. Maybe she was praying. Maybe she was just bored. I know that a lot of his audience was. By then, most of the Harlow Methodist youth had begun to tire of electricity and its attendant glories. "Kids, science teaches us that electricity is the movement of charged atomic particles called electrons. When electrons flow, they create current, and the faster the electrons flow, the higher the voltage. That's science, and science is fine, but it's also finite. There always comes a point where knowledge runs out. What are electrons exactly?" "Charged atoms," the scientists say. "Okay, that's fine, as far as it goes. But what are atoms?" He leaned forward over the back of his chair. His blue eyes, they themselves looked electric, fixed on us. "No one really knows, and that's where religion comes in. Electricity is one of God's doorways to the infinite." "I wish he'd bring in an electric chair and fry up some white mice," Billy Paquette sniffed one evening after the benediction. "That would be interesting." In spite of the frequent and increasingly boring lectures on holy voltage, most of us looked forward to Thursday night school. When he wasn't on his hobby horse, Reverend Jacobs could give lively, sometimes funny talks with lessons drawn from Scripture. He talked about real-life problems we all faced, from bullying to the temptation to cheat answers from someone else's paper during tests we hadn't studied for. We enjoyed the games, we enjoyed most of the lessons, and we enjoyed the singing, too, because Mrs. Jacobs was a fine pianist who never dragged the hymns. She knew more than hymns, too. On one never-to-be-forgotten night, she played a trio of Beatles songs, and we sang along with "From Me to You," "She Loves You," and "I Want to Hold Your Hand." My mother claimed that Patsy Jacobs was 70 times better on the piano than Mr. Latour, and when the minister's young wife asked to spend some of the church collection money on a piano tuner from Portland, the deacons approved the request unanimously.
"But perhaps no more Beatles songs," Mr. Kelton said. He was the deacon who had served Harlow Methodist the longest. "The children can get that stuff on the radio. We'd prefer you to stick to more, Christian melodies."
Mrs. Jacobs murmured her agreement, eyes demurely cast down. There was something else as well. Charles and Patsy Jacobs had sex appeal. I've mentioned that Claire and her friends were gaga for him. It wasn't long before most of the boys had crushes on her as well, because Patsy Jacobs was beautiful. Her hair was blonde, her complexion creamy, her lips full, her slightly up-tilted eyes were green, and Connie claimed she had witchly powers, because every time she happened to shift those green eyes his way, his knees turned to water. With those kind of looks, there would have been talk if she had worn more makeup than a decorous blush of lipstick. But at 23, that was all she needed. Youth was her makeup. She wore perfectly proper knee or shin-length dresses on Sundays, even though those were the years when ladies' hemlines started their climb. On MYF Thursday nights, she wore perfectly proper slacks and blouses, ship and shore, according to my mother. But the moms and grandmoms in the congregation watched her closely just the same, because the figure those perfectly proper clothes set off was the kind that made my brother's friends sometimes roll their eyes or shake a hand the way you do after touching a stove burner someone forgot to turn off. She played softball on girls' nights, and I once overheard my brother Andy, who would have been going on 14 at the time, I think, say that watching her run the bases was a religious experience in itself. She was able to play the piano on Thursday nights and participate in most of the other MYF activities because she could bring her little boy along. He was a biddable, easy child. Everyone liked Maury. To the best of my recollection, even Billy Paquette, that young atheist in the making, liked Maury, who hardly ever cried, even when he fell down and skinned his knees. The worst he was liable to do was sniffle, and even that would stop if one of the bigger girls picked him up and cuddled him. When we went outside to play games, he followed the boys everywhere he could, and when he was unable to keep up with them, he followed the girls, who also minded him during Bible study or swung him around to the beat during sing time, hence the nickname Tag-Along Maury. Claire was particularly fond of him, and I have a clear memory, which I know must be made up of many overlaid memories, of them in the corner where the toys were, Maury in his little chair, Claire on her knees beside him, helping him to color or to construct a domino snake. "I want four just like him when I get married," Claire told my mother once. She would have been going on 17 by then, I suppose, and ready to graduate from MYF. "Good luck on that," my mother replied. "In any case, I hope yours will be better looking than Maury, Claire Bear." That was a tad unkind, but not untrue. Although Charles Jacobs was a good-looking man, and Patsy Jacobs was a downright beautiful young woman, Tag-Along Maury was as plain as mashed potatoes. He had a perfectly round face that reminded me of Charlie Brown's. His hair was a nondescript shade of brunette. Although his father's eyes were blue and his mother's that entrancing green, Maury's were plain old brown. Yet the girls all loved him, as if he were a starter child for the ones they would have in the following decade, and the boys treated him like a kid brother. He was our mascot. He was Tag-Along Maury. One February Thursday night, my four siblings and I came back from the parsonage with our cheeks red from sledding behind the church. Reverend Jacobs had set up electric lights along our run, singing "I'm Henry VIII" at the top of our lungs. I remember that Andy and Con were in a particularly hilarious mood, because they'd brought our toboggan and put Maury on a cushion at the front, where he rode fearlessly and looked like the figurehead on the prow of a ship. "You guys like those meetings, don't you?" my father asked. I think there was mild wonder in his voice.
"Yeah," I said. "We did about 1,000 Bible drills tonight, and then went out back on our sleds. Mrs. Jacobs, she sledded too, only she kept falling off. I laughed, and he laughed with me. That's great. But are you learning anything, Jamie? Man's will should be an extension of God's will, I said, parroting that night's lesson. Also, if you connect the positive and negative terminals of a battery with a wire, it makes a short circuit.
True, he said, which is why you always have to be careful when you're jump-starting a car, but I don't see any Christian lesson in that.
It was about how doing something wrong, because you thought it might make something else better, doesn't work.
Ooh. He picked up the latest issue of Car and Driver, which had a cool Jaguar XKE on the cover. Well, you know what they say, Jamie. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, he thought for a moment, then added, and lit with electric lights. That made him laugh, and I laughed with him, even though I didn't get the joke, if it was a joke. Andy and Con were friends with the Ferguson brothers, Norm and Hal. They were what we called Flatlanders, or folks from away. The Fergusons lived in Boston, so the friendship was ordinarily restricted to summer vacations. The family had a cottage on Lookout Lake, only a mile or so from our house, and the two sets of brothers met at another church-related event, in this case, Vacation Bible School. The Fergusons had a family membership at Goat Mountain Resort, and sometimes Con and Andy would go with them in the Ferguson station wagon to swim and have lunch in the club. The pool, they said, was about 1,000 times better than Harry's Pond. Neither Terry nor I cared much about this. The local swimming hole was fine by us, and we had our own friends. But it drove Claire wild with envy. She wanted to see how the other half lived. They live just like us, dear, Mom said. Whoever said the rich are different was wrong. Claire, who was running clothes through our old washing machine's wringer, scrunched her face into a pout. I doubt that, she said. Andy says the girls who swim in the pool wear bikinis, I said. My mother snorted. They might as well go swimming in their bras and underpants. I'd like to have a bikini, Claire remarked. It was, I suppose, the sort of provocation girls of 17 specialize in. My mother pointed a finger at her, soap dripping from one short-clipped nail. That's how girls get pregnant, Missy. Claire returned that serve smartly. Then you ought to keep Con and Andy from going. They might get a girl pregnant. Zip your lip, my mother said, cutting her eyes in my direction. Little pitchers have big ears. Like I didn't know what getting a girl pregnant meant. Sex. Boys lay down on top of girls and wiggled around until they got the feeling. When that happened, a mysterious something called jizz came from the boy's dink. It sank into the girl's belly, and 9 months later, it was time for diapers and a baby carriage. My parents didn't stop Con and Andy from going to the resort once or twice a week during the summer, in spite of my sister's dog in the manger barking. And when the Fergusons came up for February vacation in 1965 and invited my brothers to go skiing with them, my parents sent them off to Goat Mountain without a qualm. My brothers' scarred old skis strapped to the station wagon's roof, right along with the Fergusons' gleaming new ones. When they came back, there was a bright red wheel across Con's throat. "Did you drift off course and run into a tree branch?" Dad asked when he came home for supper and saw the mark. Con, a fine skier, was indignant.
"Gosh, no, Dad. Me and Norm were racing. We were side by side, going like Hell's Kitchen."
Mom pointed her fork at him.
"Sorry, Mom."
"Like Heck's Kitchen. Norm hit a mogul and just about lost his balance. He stuck out his arm like this,"
Con demonstrated, almost knocking over his glass of milk.
"And his ski pole hit me in the neck. It hurt like, you know, bad, but it's better now."
Only it wasn't. The next day the red mark had faded to a necklace-like bruise, but his voice had gotten hoarse. By that night, he could hardly speak above a whisper. 2 days later, he was completely mute.
a hyperextension of the neck resulting in a stretched laryngeal nerve. That was Dr. Renault's diagnosis. He had seen them before, and in a week or two, Conrad's voice would begin to come back. By the end of March, Connie would be right as a trivet. Nothing to worry about, he said, and there wasn't. Not for him, at least. His voice was fine. This was not true of my brother. When April rolled around, Con was still writing notes and making gestures when he wanted something. He insisted on going to school, even though the other boys had started making fun of him, especially since he had solved the problem of class participation, to a degree anyway, by writing yes on one palm and no on the other. He had a pile of file cards with more communications written on them in block letters. The one his classmates found particularly hilarious was, "May I use the restroom?" Con seemed to take all this in good spirits, knowing that to do otherwise would only make the teasing worse. But one night, I went into the room he shared with Terry and found him lying on his bed and weeping soundlessly. I went to him, asking what was wrong. A stupid question, since I knew. But you have to say something in that situation. And I could say it, because I wasn't the one who'd been struck across the throat with the ski pole of destiny.
"Get out," he mouthed.
His cheeks and forehead, studded with newly arrived pimples, were flaming. His eyes were swollen.
"Get out! Get out!"
Then, shocking me,
"Get the fuck out, cocksucker!"
The first gray began to appear in my mother's hair that spring. One afternoon, when my father came in, looking more tired than usual, Mom told him they had to take Con to a specialist in Portland. "We've waited long enough," she said. "That old fool George Renault can say whatever he likes, but I know what happened, and so do you. That careless rich boy ruptured my son's vocal cords." My father sat down heavily at the table. Neither of them noticed me in the mudroom, taking an inordinate amount of time to lace up my keds. "We can't afford it, Laura," he said. "But you could afford to buy Hiram Oil in Gates Falls," she said, using an ugly, almost sneering tone of voice I had never heard before. He sat, looking at the table instead of at her, although there was nothing on it except the red and white checked oilcloth. "That's why we can't afford it. We're skating on mighty thin ice. You know what kind of winter it was." We all knew. A warm one. When your family's income depends on heating oil, you keep a close eye on the thermometer between Thanksgiving and Easter, hoping the red line will stay low. My mother was at the sink, hands buried in a cloud of soap suds. Somewhere beneath the cloud, dishes were rattling as if she wanted to break them instead of clean them. "You had to have it, didn't you?" Still in that same tone of voice. I hated that voice. It was as if she was egging him on. "The big oil baron." "That deal was made before Con's accident," he said, still not looking up. His hands were once more stuffed deep into his pockets. "That deal was made in August. We sat together looking at the old farmer's almanac. A cold and snowy winter, it said, coldest since the end of World War II. And we decided it was the right thing to do. You ran the numbers on your adding machine." The dishes rattled harder under the soap suds. "Take out a loan." "I could, but Laura, listen to me." He raised his eyes at last. "I may have to do that, just to make it through the summer." "He's your son. I know he is, goddammit," Dad roared. It scared me, and must have scared my mother, because this time the dishes under the cloud of suds did more than rattle. They crashed. And when she raised her hands, one of them was bleeding. She held it up to him, like my silent brother showing yes or no in class, and said, "Look what you made me do." She caught sight of me, sitting on the woodpile and staring into the kitchen. "Buzz off. Go out and play." "Laura, don't take it out on you." "Get out," she shouted. It was the way Con would have shouted at me if he'd had a voice to shout with. "God hates a snoop." She began to cry. I ran out the door, crying myself. I ran down Methodist Hill and across Route 9 without looking in either direction. I had no idea of going to the parsonage. I was too upset to even think of seeking pastoral advice. If Patsy Jacobs hadn't been in the front yard, checking to see if any of the flowers she'd planted the previous fall were coming up, I might have run until I collapsed. But she was out, and she called my name. Part of me wanted to just keep on running, but, as I think I've said, I had my manners, even when I was upset. So I stopped. She came to where I was standing, my head down, gasping for breath. "What happened, Jamie?" I didn't say anything. She put her fingers under my chin and raised my head. I saw Maury sitting on the grass beside the parsonage's front stoop, surrounded by toy trucks. He was goggling at me.
"Jamie, tell me what's wrong."
Just as we had been taught to be polite, we had been taught to keep our mouths shut about what went on in the family. It was the Yankee way. But her kindness undid me, and it all came pouring out. Con's misery, the depth of which I'm convinced neither of our parents comprehended, in spite of their very real concern. My mother's fear that his vocal cords had been ruptured, and he might never speak again. Her insistence on a specialist, and Dad's on how they couldn't afford it. Most of all, the shouting. I didn't tell Patsy about the stranger's voice I had heard coming from my mother's mouth, but only because I could not think how to say it. When I finally ran down, she said, "Come around to the back shed. You need to talk to Charlie." Now that the Belvedere had taken its proper place in the parsonage garage, the back shed had become Jacob's workshop. When Patsy led me in, he was tinkering with a television set that had no screen. "When I put this puppy back together," he said, slinging an arm around my shoulders and producing a handkerchief from his back pocket, "I'll be able to get TV stations in Miami, Chicago, and Los Angeles." "Wipe your eyes, Jamie, and your nose could use a little attention while you're at it." I looked at the eyeless TV with fascination as I cleaned up. "Will you really be able to get stations in Chicago and Los Angeles?" "No, I was kidding. I'm just trying to build in a signal amplifier that will let us get something besides Channel 8.
"We get 6 and 13, too," I said. "Although 6 is a little snowstormy."
"You guys have a roof antenna. The Jacobs family is stuck with rabbit ears."
"Why don't you buy one? They sell them at Western Auto in Castle Rock."
He grinned. "Good idea. I'll stand up in front of the deacons at quarterly meeting and tell them I want to spend some of the collection money on a TV antenna, so Maury can watch Mighty 90, and the missus and I can watch Petticoat Junction on Tuesday nights." "Never mind that, Jamie. Tell me what's got you in such a tizzy." I looked around for Mrs. Jacobs, hoping she'd spare me the job of having to tell everything twice, but she had quietly decamped. He took me by the shoulders and led me to a sawhorse. I was just tall enough to be able to sit on it. "Is it Con?" Of course he'd guessed that. A petition for the return of Con's voice was part of the closing prayer at every Thursday night meeting that spring, as were prayers for other MYFers who were going through hard times. Broken bones were the most common, but Bobby Underwood had suffered burns, and Carrie Doughty had to endure having her head shaved and rinsed with vinegar after her horrified mother discovered the little girl's scalp was crawling with lice. But, like his wife, Reverend Jacobs hadn't had any idea of how miserable Con really was, or how that misery had spread through the entire family like an especially nasty germ.
"Dad bought Hiram Oil last summer," I said, starting to blubber again. I hated it. Blubbering was such a little kid's trick, but I couldn't seem to help it. "He said the price was too good to turn down, only then we had a warm winter, and heating oil went down to 15 cents a gallon, and now they can't afford a specialist, and if you could have heard her, she didn't sound like Mom at all, and sometimes he puts his hands in his pockets because..."
But Yankee reticence finally kicked in, and I finished.
"Because I don't know why."
He produced the handkerchief again, and while I used it, he took a metal box from his workshop table. Wires sprouted from it every which way, like badly cut hair. "Behold the amplifier," he said, "invented by yours truly. Once I get it hooked up, I'll run a wire out the window and up to the eave, and then I will attach that."
He pointed to the corner, where a rake was propped on his pole with its rusty metal tine sticking up. The Jacobs Custom Antenna.
Will it work?
I asked.
I don't know.
I think it will. But even if it does, I believe the days of television antennas are numbered. In another 10 years, TV signals will be carried along the telephone lines, and there'll be a lot more than 3 channels. By 1990 or so, the signals will be beamed down from satellites. I know it sounds like science fiction, but the technology already exists. He had this dreamy look, and I thought, he's forgotten all about Khan. Now I know that wasn't true. He was just giving me time to regain my composure and, maybe, himself time to think. People will be amazed at first, and then they'll take it for granted. They'll say, oh, yes, we have telephone TV, or we have Earth satellite TV. But they'll be wrong. It's all a gift of electricity, which is now so basic and so pervasive we have a way of ignoring it. People like to say, thus and such is the elephant in the living room, meaning a thing that's too big to be ignored. But you'd even ignore an elephant if it was in the living room long enough.
Except when you had to clean up the poop, I said.
That made him roar with laughter, and I laughed along with him, even though my eyes were still swollen from crying. He went to the window and looked out. He clasped his hands at the small of his back and didn't speak for a long time. Then he turned to me and said, I want you to bring Khan to the parsonage tonight. Will you do that?
Sure,
I said, without any great enthusiasm. More praying is what I thought he had in store. And I knew it couldn't hurt, but there had been a lot of praying on Khan's behalf already, and it hadn't helped either. My parents had no objections to our going to the parsonage. I had to ask them separately, because that night they were barely talking to each other. It was Connie who took convincing, probably because I wasn't very convinced myself. But because I had promised the Reverend, I didn't give up. I enlisted Claire for help instead. Her belief in the power of prayer was far greater than my own, and she had her own powers. I think they came from being the only girl. Of the 4 Morton brothers, only Andy, who was closest to her in age, could resist her when she got all pretty-eyed and asked for something. As the 3 of us crossed Route 9, our shadows long in the light of a rising full moon, Khan, just 13 that year, dark-haired, slender, dressed in a faded plaid jacket handed down from Andy, held up his notepad, which he carried everywhere. He had printed while he walked, so the letters were jagged.
This is stupid.
Maybe, Claire said, but we'll get cookies. Mrs. Jacobs always has cookies.
We also got Maury, now 5 and dressed for bed in his PJs. He ran directly to Khan and jumped into his arms.
Still can't talk?
Maury asked. Khan shook his head.
My dad will fix you, he said. He's been working all afternoon.
Then he held his arms out to my sister.
Carry me, Claire. Carry me, Claire Bear, and I'll give you a kiss.
She took him from Khan, laughing. Reverend Jacobs was in the shed, dressed in faded jeans and a sweater. There was an electric heater in the corner, the elements glowing cherry red, but his workshop was still cold. I suppose he had been too busy tinkering away on his various projects to winterize it. The temporarily eyeless TV had been covered with a mover's quilt. Jacobs gave Claire a hug and a peck on the cheek, then shook hands with Khan, who then held up his pad.
More prayer, I suppose,
was printed on the fresh page. I thought that was a little rude, and by her frown I could see Claire felt the same, but Jacobs only smiled.
We might get to that,
but I want to try something else first. He turned to me. Whom does the Lord help, Jamie?
Them that help themselves,
I said. Ungrammatical, but true. He went to the work table and brought back what looked like either a fat cloth belt or the world's skinniest electric blanket. A cord dangled from it, going to a little white plastic box with a slide switch on top. Jacob stood with the belt in his hands, looking at Khan gravely.
This is a project I've been tinkering with on and off for the last year. I call it the electrical nerve stimulator.
One of your inventions? I said.
Not exactly. The idea of using electricity to limit pain and stimulate muscles is very, very old. 60 years before the birth of Christ, a Roman doctor named Scribonius Largus discovered that foot and leg pain could be alleviated if the sufferer stepped firmly on an electric eel.
You made that up, Claire accused, laughing.
Con wasn't laughing. He was staring at the cloth belt with fascination.
Not at all, Jacob said.
But mine uses small batteries, which are of my invention, for power. Electric eels are hard to come by in central Maine, and even harder to put around a boy's neck, which is what I intend to do with this homemade ENS gadget of mine. Because Dr. Renault might have been right about your vocal cords not being ruptured, Con. Maybe they only need a jump start. I'm willing to make the experiment, but it's up to you. What do you say? Con nodded. In his eyes, I saw an expression that hadn't been there in quite a while. Hope.
How come you never showed us this in MYF? Claire asked.
She sounded almost accusing. Jacobs looked surprised and a tiny bit uneasy. I suppose I couldn't think how it connected to a Christian lesson. Until Jamie came to see me today, I was thinking of trying it out on Al Knowles. His unfortunate accident. We all nodded, the fingers lost in the potato grater. He still feels the fingers that aren't there, and says they hurt. Also, he's lost a good deal of his ability to move that hand because of nerve damage. As I said, I've known for years that electricity can help in matters like those. Now it looks like you'll be my guinea pig, Con.
So having that handy was just a lucky break? Claire asked.
I couldn't see why it mattered, but it seemed to her, at least. Jacobs looked at her reproachfully and said,
Coincidence and lucky break are words people with little faith use to describe the will of God, Claire.
She flushed at that and looked down at her sneakers. Con, meanwhile, was scribbling on his pad. He held it up.
Will it hurt?
I don't think so, Jacobs said. The current is very low, minuscule, really. I've tried it on my arm, like a blood pressure cuff, and felt no more than the tingle you get when your arm or leg has been asleep and is just beginning to wake up. If there is pain, raise your hands, and I'll kill the current right away. I'm going to put this thing on now. It'll be snug, but not tight. You'll be able to breathe just fine. The buckles are nylon. Can't use metal on a thing like this. He put the belt around Con's neck. It looked like a bulky winter scarf. Con's eyes were wide and scared, but when Jacobs asked if he was ready, he nodded. I felt Claire's fingers close over mine. They were cold. I thought Jacobs might get to the prayer then, asking for success. In a way, I suppose he did. He bent down so he could look Con directly in the eyes and said, "Expect a miracle." Con nodded. I saw the cloth around his throat rise and fall as he swallowed hard. All right, here we go. When Reverend Jacob slid the switch on top of the control box, I heard a faint humming sound. Con's head jerked. His mouth twitched first at one corner, then at the other. His fingers began to flutter rapidly, and his arms jerked. "Does it hurt?" Jacobs asked. His index finger was hovering over the switch, ready to turn it off. If it hurts, hold out your hands. Con shook his head. Then, in a voice that sounded as if it were coming through a mouthful of gravel, he said,
Doesn't hurt. Warm.
Claire and I exchanged a wild glance, a thought as strong as telepathy flowing between us. Did I hear that? She was now squeezing my hand hard enough to hurt. But I didn't care. When we looked back at Jacobs, he was smiling. Don't try to talk. Not yet. I'm going to run the belt for 2 minutes by my watch. Unless it starts to hurt, if that happens, hold out your hands and I'll turn it off at once.
Con didn't hold out his hands, although his fingers continued to move up and down as if he were playing an invisible piano. His upper lip lifted a few times in an involuntary snarl, and his eyes went through spasms of fluttering. Once, still in that grating, gravelly voice, he said,
"I can talk again."
"Hush," Jacob said sternly. His index finger hovered over the switch, ready to kill the current, his eyes on the moving second hand of his watch. After what seemed like an eternity, he pushed the switch, and that faint hum died. He unloosed the buckles and pulled the belt over my brother's head. Con's hands went immediately to his neck. The skin there was a little flushed, but I don't think that was from the electric current. It was from the pressure of the belt. "Now, Con, I want you to say, 'My dog has fleas. They bite his knees. But if your throat starts to hurt, stop at once.'"
"My dog has fleas,"
Con said in his strange, grating voice.
"They bite his knees."
"Then
I have to spit."
"Does your throat hurt?"
"No, just have to spit."
Claire opened the shed door. Con leaned out, cleared his throat, which produced an unpleasantly metallic sound like rusty hinges, and hawked a loogie that, to me, looked almost as big as a doorknob. He turned back to us, massaging his throat with one hand.
"My dog has fleas."
He still didn't sound like the Con I remembered, but the words were clearer now, and more human. Tears rose in his eyes and began to spill down his cheeks.
"They bite his knees."
"That's enough for now," Jacob said. "We'll go in the house, and you'll drink a glass of water, a big one. You must drink a lot of water, tonight and tomorrow, until your voice sounds normal again. Will you do that?"
"Yes."
"When you get home, you may tell your mother and father hello, and then I want you to go into your room and get down on your knees and thank God for bringing your voice back. Will you do that?" Con nodded vehemently. He was crying harder than ever. And he wasn't alone. Claire and I were crying, too. Only Reverend Jacobs was dry-eyed. I think he was too amazed to cry. Patsy was the only one not surprised. When we went into the house, she squeezed Con's arm and said in a matter-of-fact voice, "That's a good boy." Maury hugged my brother, and my brother hugged him back hard enough to make the little boy's eyes bug out. Patsy drew a glass of water from the kitchen tap, and Con drank all of it. When he thanked her, it was almost in his own voice. "You're very welcome, Con. Now it's well past Maury's bedtime, and time for you kids to go home." Leading Maury to the stairs by the hand, but not turning around, she added, "I think your parents are going to be very happy." That was the understatement of the century. They were in the living room, watching the Virginian, and still not talking. Even in my joy and excitement, I could feel the freeze between them. Andy and Terry were thumping around upstairs, grousing at each other about something. Business as usual, in other words. Mom had an Afghan square in her lap and was bending over to unsnarl the yarn in her basket when Con said, "Hello, Mom."
"Hello, Dad."
Dad stared at him, mouth open. Mom froze, one hand in the basket and the other holding her needles. She looked up very slowly. She said, "What?"
"Hello,"
Con said again. She screamed and flew out of her chair, kicking the knitting basket over, and grabbed him the way she sometimes had when we were little and meant to give one of us a shaking for something we had done wrong. There was no shaking that night. She swept Con into her arms, weeping. I could hear Terry and Andy stampeding down from the second floor to see what was going on. "Say something else," she cried. "Say something else so I don't think I just dreamed it." "He's not supposed to," Claire began, but Con interrupted her because now he could.
"I love you, Mom," he said. "I love you, Dad."
Dad took Con by the shoulders and looked closely at his throat, but there was now nothing to see. The red mark had faded.
"Thank God," he said. "Thank God, son."
Claire and I looked at each other, and once more the thought didn't need to be spoken. Reverend Jacobs deserved some thanks, too. We explained about how Con was supposed to use his voice sparingly to start with, and when we told about the water, Annie went out to the kitchen and came back with Dad's oversized joke coffee cup. Printed on the side was the Canadian flag and 1 imperial gallon of caffeine, filled with water. While he drank it, Claire and I took turns recounting what had happened, with Con chipping in once or twice, telling about the tingling sensation he'd felt when the belt was turned on. Each time he interrupted, Claire scolded him for talking.
"I don't believe it."
Mom said this several times. She couldn't seem to take her eyes off Con. Several times she grabbed him and hugged him, as if she was afraid he might sprout wings, turn into an angel, and fly away. "If the church didn't pay for his heating oil," Dad said when the tale was finished, "Reverend Jacobs would never have to pay for another gallon." "We'll think of something," Mom said distractedly. "Right now we're going to celebrate. Terry, fetch the ice cream we were saving for Claire's birthday from the freezer. It'll be good for Con's throat. You and Andy put it on the table. We'll have all of it, so use the big bowls. You don't mind, do you, Claire?" She shook her head.
"This is better than a birthday party."
"I have to go to the bathroom," Connie said. "All that water. Then I'm supposed to pray. Reverend said so. The rest of you stay out while I do it."
He went upstairs. Andy and Terry went into the kitchen to serve out the Neapolitan, which we called Van Chalk Straw. Funny how it all comes back. My mother and father subsided into their chairs, staring at the TV without seeing it. I saw Mom grope out with one hand, and saw Dad take it without looking, as if he knew it was there. That made me happy and relieved. I felt a tug on my own hand. It was Claire. She led me through the kitchen, where Andy and Terry were squabbling over the relative size of the portions, and into the mudroom. Her eyes, when she looked at me, were wide and bright. "Did you see him?" she asked. "No," demanded.
"Who?"
"Reverend Jacobs, stupid. Did you see him when I asked why he never showed us that electric belt in MYF?
"Well, yeah."
"He said he'd been working on it for a year, but if that was true, he would have showed it off. He shows off everything he makes." I remembered how surprised he had looked, as if Claire had caught him out. I had, on more than one occasion, felt the same expression on my own face when I'd been caught out, but...
"Are you saying he was lying?"
She nodded vigorously.
"Yes, he was. And his wife, she knew it. Do you know what I think? I think he started right after you were there. Maybe he already had the idea. I think he has thousands of ideas for electrical inventions. They must pop around in his head like corn. But he hadn't done anything at all on this one until today."
"Gee, Claire, I don't think..." She was still holding my hand. Now she gave it a hard and impatient yank, as if I were stuck in the mud and needed help to get free.
"Did you see their kitchen table? There was one plate still set, with nothing on the plate and nothing in the glass. He skipped his supper so he could keep working. Working like a demon, I guess, from the look of his hands. They were all red, and there were blisters on 2 of his fingers."
"He did all that for Con?"
"I don't think so," she said. Her eyes never left mine.
"Claire, Jamie," Mom called, "come for ice cream." Claire didn't even look toward the kitchen.
"Of all the kids in MYF, you're the one he met first, and you're the one he likes the best. He did it for you, Jamie. He did it for you."
Then she went into the kitchen, leaving me to stand by the woodpile, feeling stunned. If Claire had stayed a little longer, and I'd had a chance to get over my surprise, I might have told her my own intuition. Reverend Jacobs had been as surprised as we were. He hadn't expected it to work.